KBOO program's been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, now offering Peaberry Especial, a blend of rare pea berries from Colombia, New Guinea, and Tanzania. For a limited time at Pete's retail stores or on the web at Pete's.com.
Good morning. Here comes the KBOO News for Monday, February 27th. I'm Blaine Palmer.
And I'm Martha Odom. In Washington, two more environmentalists have been charged with sabotage.
The Dubai Ports World debate got hotter over the weekend.
A self-styled American preacher has been arrested in Uganda on terrorism charges.
All those stories and more coming up. Portland area weather today, rain at times, be decreasing in the afternoon, highs in the 50s tonight. There's a chance of showers in the evening and lows 35 to 40 degrees. Otis Chandler, publisher of the Los Angeles Times, died today. Chandler transformed his family's newspaper from a provincial conservative paper into a respected national media voice. He was 78 years old. Two more people have been arrested in connection with a 2001 arson at a Clatskanie tree farm. The arrests bring to 14 the number of people indicted in a broad-ranging investigation of politically motivated arsons in five western states. Federal agents arrested Nathan Fraser Block and Joanna Zacher at their home in Olympia. U.S. Attorney Karen Immergut said agents also executed a search warrant at the home. Block and Zacher will be extradited to Eugene to stand trial with four other people, charged in connection with the fire that destroyed buildings and trucks at Jefferson Poplar Farm in May 2001. They face 12 counts each of arson, one count of attempted arson, and a count of using and carrying a destructive device in relation to a crime of violence. That's a charge that carries a minimum prison sentence of 30 years. The arrests are the latest in a 9-year joint investigation by the FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. So far, 14 people have been indicted in connection with arson and other acts of sabotage, totaling more than $20 million in damage from 1996 to 2001.
An outspoken Arizona environmental activist is in federal custody after a court hearing last Thursday. FSRN Evan Davis reports from Arizona.
On Arizona after federal agents arrested him on Wednesday. During yesterday's court appearance, Coronado was charged with felony distribution of information relating to a destructive device for allegedly giving instructions on how to create an incendiary device during a speech he gave in San Diego in 2003. A San Diego area housing development that was under construction was destroyed by arson less than 24 hours before Coronado's speech there, but Coronado is not being charged with setting the blaze, which Earth Liberation Front took credit for at the time. Coronado is being held in detention in Tucson and is expected to be transferred on Monday to a federal court in San Diego. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Arizona.
A new invention by an Oregon State University engineer offers an intriguing peek at what could be, for some, a do-it-yourself fuel. It's a tiny chemical reactor that can turn vegetable oil and alcohol into biodiesel. The microreactor is the invention of OSU chemical engineering professor Goran Jovanovic. Jovanovic said, "This could be as important an invention as the mouse for your PC. If we're successful with this, nobody will ever make biodiesel any other way." Homemade fuel would be a natural for farmers who could even produce the vegetable oil from soybeans or oilseed crops. The average car owner might never get a home biodiesel kit for Christmas, but the new technology could help reduce dependence on foreign oil. It could also shift some fuel production from centralized refineries to clean local producers. That shift is still a ways off, if it ever comes at all, but Jovanovic's microreactor is a step along the path. What's needed now is some private investment. Jovanovic is working with the Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnologies Institute to drum up funding. He wants to do a demonstration project that would show the technology will work on a commercial scale. This from the Eugene Register-Guard.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has awarded an Oregon State University researcher $100,000 to develop a test to quickly detect avian influenza in chickens and other birds. Rapid, accurate diagnosis is crucial in preventing widespread outbreaks of disease in birds as well as possible transmission to humans, said Manoy Pasty, an assistant professor of biomedical sciences at the university's College of Veterinary Medicine. Pasty hopes to produce tests that give reliable results within hours of testing. Bird flu can cause severe economic losses to poultry growers, but the threat of a deadly strain spreading from bird to people and starting a worldwide pandemic has pushed scientists to renew efforts to prevent and control the spread of avian viruses. Most viral strains typically cause few, if any, symptoms in infected birds, complicating efforts to detect disease within flocks. And relatively mild strains of bird flu are capable of mutating into highly virulent strains of the disease.
Saturday night, KBOO's Annalisa Hummel spoke at the biggest local event of the year for the international relief organization Clowns Without Borders. Here's what she had to say with group member Sarah Liana Foster.
Sarah, thank you for coming down to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Please tell us about Clowns Without Borders. What do you do?
Clowns Without Borders sends performers to relieve suffering through laughter in different parts of the world in crisis. We focus particularly on children who've experienced trauma due to being in refugee camps or in areas that have experienced natural disaster.
All right. We laugh to survive.
Yes.
I have that on a little card in my kitchen.
I think it's true.
Uh-huh. We understand that you have been to Haiti and recently returned from South Africa. Can you tell us what you did and where exactly you went to perform?
Well, last month when I was in South Africa, we spent about half of the time outside of Johannesburg in different townships and the other half outside of Durban, both in areas that had been hit hard by the AIDS epidemic, and we performed clown shows and taught workshops to primarily orphans.
How does it help to do clown shows in a disaster area? What is it really like for the families and the children, and what does it mean to them?
Well, I think sometimes going into the show, it was amazing to see how excited children would be. We'd drive into a pretty poor area where houses would sometimes be made of, we'd see houses made of tarps and pieces of corrugated iron, and then drive in, and the kids would be so excited they would almost, one time kids almost pushed down the wall of the building where we were getting ready to do the show because they wanted to see it. And then afterwards they would act out parts of it, parts of the show that we'd just done, which really brought home how much sometimes they remembered it made a difference to them.
All right. What else do you do outside of performing?
Well, we also teach clown workshops mostly to kids. We were at orphanages and different orphan centers, and we actually got to stay for about a week at a time at a couple of orphanages and do residencies that culminated in the kids themselves performing shows.
Are there many orphanages as far as you know?
I think that there are quite a few. We spent time at two long-term and visited probably 8 or 10 other ones during our short stay there. And the kids were so excited, especially we built 10 pairs of stilts, and they couldn't get enough of the stilts. They were really excited. They juggled and did little clown sketches.
And Sarah, what do you do when you're not volunteering with the clowns?
I perform, we create and perform shows with the Nomadic Theater Company here in town, and also teach school residencies, and we're getting ready for the big show tomorrow.
Oh yeah, so that is about, the event is tomorrow night?
Mm-hmm. It's tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Winningstad Theater, which is at 1111 Southwest Broadway, and it's going to feature live music by Shoehorn and the Von Taff Quartet and some of the best physical and vaudevillian performers in town.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. for being here. That was Sarah Liana Foster of Clowns Without Borders. Find out more about the group on the web at clownswithoutborders.org or go to comedytricks.com.
That was KBOO's Annalisa Hummel.
A radical environmental activist has been indicted by a federal grand jury for demonstrating how to build a firebomb in a speech just 15 hours after a fire that his group claimed responsibility for destroyed a large apartment complex being built nearby. Rodney Adam Coronado, a 39-year-old member of the Earth Liberation Front, was indicted on a charge of giving instructions on how to build a destructive device which carries a maximum sentence of 20 years in federal prison. The law under which he was charged has been used just four other times since it was enacted in 1997, according to Assistant U.S. Attorney Shane Harrigan. The law makes it illegal to tell others how to build destructive devices with the intent of having them commit crimes. Harrigan said, in the speech, Coronado mentioned the fire that had just occurred. We have to prove his intent was to have others go out and commit arson. No one has been charged in the August 1st, 2003 early morning fire that did about $50 million in damage to the complex being built in University Town Center, a high technology and business center near the University of California, San Diego. The Earth Liberation Front took responsibility for the fire, leaving a banner at the site and sending an email to a local newspaper. Coronado has told reporters he showed people how to build a firebomb, which he used to destroy an animal testing facility in Michigan in 1992. He served 4 years in prison for that arson.
The head of California's prison system said he's resigning after more than 2 years on the job because his efforts lacked political support. Corrections Secretary Roderick Hickman said the governor would receive an official letter of resignation today. Governor's office said yesterday the department's undersecretary, Gene Woodford, will temporarily fill the top post. Hickman frequently came under fire from legislators, union officials, and prison watchdog groups. They criticized his lack of progress cleaning up California's $8 billion prison system. Under Hickman, the department started a new parole program designed to keep more inmates from returning to prison by easing their transition back to normal life. And while he believes the governor remains interested in prison reform, Hickman said the special interests we're up against are just too powerful to get much done in the current environment. California Correctional Peace Officers Association has fought with Hickman since he took the job, even though he began his career as a prison guard and was a union member for 20 years. Union leaders initially were upset with Hickman for his campaign to purge the prisons of the code of silence. Hickman and others said that code deterred guards from reporting misconduct by colleagues.
The FBI determined a powdery substance found in a roll of quarters at a University of Texas dormitory was not ricin. The news came after initial state test had indicated it was the potentially deadly poison. The FBI test did not identify the substance, but they came back negative for the poison that is extracted from castor beans, said San Antonio FBI spokesman Renee Salinas. The mystery powder spilled onto a student's hands as she unwrapped a roll of quarters in her dorm room on Thursday. She said she used five other rolls of quarters her mother had gotten from the same bank, and none had the powder in them. Ricin is derived from the castor bean. The plant is readily available in garden centers throughout Oregon. It is popular for its flamboyant, colorful foliage and bright red berries. To date, the federal government has made no move to ban or restrict sales of the deadly yet lovely plant.
A growing number of governors along the border and beyond are sharpening their complaints about the flood of immigrants pouring into their states. They're pushing the Bush administration and Congress for action. Republicans and Democrats alike yesterday said they plan to bring their concerns to President Bush and his cabinet in private meetings this week. The move brings to the front a security worry of a different order than the latest Washington obsessions on ports and eavesdropping. Immigration was one contentious issue among many as more than 40 top state leaders gathered for the winter meeting of the National Governors Association. Governors also hope to get attention on the National Guard, where they are fear cuts, and on Medicaid and welfare. Bush hosted the governors at a formal White House dinner last night. Here's what he had to say. I like being around governors. Governors are results-oriented people. We look forward to working with you to help shape the future of the country. After Bush spoke, they were to be entertained with music from New Orleans singer Aaron Neville. From states as far from the southern border as Utah, Missouri, Tennessee, and Vermont, governors said immigrants are costing states dollars and spurring state legislation. All agree the answer lies in Washington and hope to provide a push as Congress weighs several competing bills.
A national environmental group has charged that the Environmental Protection Agency is not doing enough to warn residents returning to New Orleans of health risks. The report released last Thursday by the National Resources Defense Council is the latest in a series of charges by the NRDC and other groups that the EPA is ignoring its own guidelines in dealing with the contamination caused by post-Katrina flooding. FSRN's Christian Roseland has more from the Crescent City.
Even if the truths are hard, we still need to hear the truth.
Pam DeShiel of the Holy Cross Neighborhood Association says that she has been trying to get accurate information on contamination in New Orleans for years before the storm, and that returning residents would not know about the severe contamination issues in the city without the NRDC.
We would not have known the extent of the problem, and nor would we have understood its significance. And that's, I mean, it just seems that a private nonprofit organization that does not have the vast resources of the EPA has provided more of a public benefit in terms of information and analysis than the EPA has.
The report released yesterday states that the levels of lead, arsenic, and dangerous petroleum compounds in multiple locations around the city should have triggered a massive cleanup or at least further investigation. The NRDC's report follows an independent peer-reviewed study released last Monday by Texas Tech and Xavier Universities, which found higher levels of contaminants in the soil than previous EPA tests. Tom Harris of Louisiana's Department of Environmental Quality responded by telling the Washington Post yesterday that the NRDC was grossly misusing the EPA data and said that the state's threshold levels would have to be greatly exceeded before children are harmed. DeShiel says that the Holy Cross Neighborhood Association has joined the NRDC in calling for toxic soil in the city to be removed and replaced. She says that soil contamination is not an issue to be underestimated.
Well, people do grow vegetables and flowers in their yards that they bring into their homes. Children play outside. Old people in New Orleans, people sit outside all the time. I mean, that's part of our great culture. And so soil contamination is a real issue.
For FSRN, I'm Christian Roseland.
Mardi Gras revelers crowded the sidewalks of storm-shattered New Orleans yesterday. The turnout was lighter than years past, but large enough to line the streets, fill the bars, and remind people of better days. Partiers with beers in hand jostled along Bourbon Street in the historic French Quarter. Parades marched along avenues that 6 months ago were underwater or plagued by looters in the aftermath of powerful Hurricane Katrina. Police say crowds were smaller than usual as the Mardi Gras season neared its Tuesday conclusion. But local residents said this year's pre-Lenten celebration had brought people together in a special way after the shared tragedy of Katrina. In previous years, a million people would cram into New Orleans for the climactic final weekend of Mardi Gras. But some officials estimated this year's crowd at 400,000. They said the turnout was not bad. Only about 190,000 people now live in the city that once had nearly 500,000 residents, and that large parts of it still lie in ruins from Katrina's floods. This according to Reuters.
The White House got a gift in the port security debate, a chance for the president to sidestep a battle with members of his own party and to tone down bipartisan criticism of the deal. The offer by Dubai-owned DP World to submit to a broader review of security issues in its deal to take over major operations at six U.S. ports also could salvage a business deal critically important to its economic future. The administration said Sunday it would move forward with the new review as soon as the DP World offer is formalized. President Bush had been steadfast in his support of the agreement, despite a political furor among lawmakers questioning the security risks of having a United Arab Emirate company with such a significant presence at seaports. Bush threatened to veto any legislation that would block the deal. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist and House Speaker Dennis Hastert had raised concerns about the deal, and Republican and Democrats alike vowed legislation that would force a review of national security issues surrounding it. But behind the scenes, the administration took part in discussions that would give the administration a way to save face if the company was taking the initiative and would submit to further review. The hope was that congressional critics would be quieted and the president would not have to take on a fight with a well-positioned Congress or appear that he was giving in to their demands. Late yesterday, White House spokesman Scott McClellan said the White House and the Treasury Department had been involved in a number of conversations over the weekend between the company and Congress.
Some Republicans in Alexandria, Louisiana, acknowledge Bush's appeal is waning as he enters the final years of his presidency. But whether that will hurt them at the polls is another matter. On the face of it, Louisiana should be a prime Democratic target. It's a state that voted twice for the Democrat Bill Clinton before swinging behind the Republican Bush in the last two presidential elections. 52 soldiers from Louisiana have died in Iraq, and even loyal Republicans admit the response to Hurricane Katrina, which devastated New Orleans in August, was unsatisfactory. Despite that, none of the state's five Republican seats in the U.S. Congress is seen as in danger in November's election. In line with white Southern voters' shift from Democratic blue to Republican red since the 1970s, after the Democrats shifted to support civil rights for blacks, Republicans have successfully harnessed social and religious conservatism. Alexandria's Congressman Rodney Alexander, who stands on a tax-cutting, pro-gun, and anti-abortion platform, switched from the Democrats in 2004 to run as a Republican and saw his vote share rise to 59% from 50% in 2002. Early polls have showed Republican Representative Bobby Jindal would beat Governor Kathleen Blanco easily in next year's governor's race, possibly helped because thousands of black voters were moved out of the state after Katrina.
Congress is back in Washington, and amid the debate over port security, the Senate today begins what are expected to be final deliberations on renewing the Patriot Act. The renewal has been delayed twice while lawmakers worked to balance civil liberties with the tools given to law enforcement. Just before the Senate left on its midwinter break, it rejected an effort to block the renewal. A final Senate vote is expected on Wednesday.
More evidence surfaces of Christian evangelicals being folded into U.S. intelligence operations. WMR has previously reported on Christian evangelical groups linked to an entity called Mission Aviation Fellowship being involved in off-the-books operations in Afghanistan involving transporting Afghan warlords and high-grade heroin. 2 days ago, just before Uganda's first multi-party elections in 20 years, Ugandan police arrested Peter Waldron in Kampala, along with three Ugandan nationals and a citizen of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Waldron had a business card that identified him as a founder of City of Faith Ministries and an advisor to an organization called Contact America Group. Waldron was also identified as a freelance journalist, a photographer, and a correspondent for a newsletter called the Africa Dispatch. Waldron had built himself in an interview with the New Republic as a preacher and information technology consultant. Waldron told the magazine that he was a former member of the U.S. military who became a missionary. He also claimed he was a radio talk show host, Republican Party campaign advisor, and GOP lobbyist. Waldron had worked with the Ugandan Health Ministry since 2002. However, Waldron was also caught in Kampala with four assault rifles and 180 rounds of ammunition. Waldron's publisher was noticed seated in the Ugandan High Court during the show trial of Uganda's opposition leader, Colonel Kizza Besigye, who is giving Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, a close U.S. ally, a strong challenge in today's election. Waldron was charged with terrorism. A U.S. Embassy spokeswoman said she could not reveal any details about Waldron, citing his protections under the U.S. government's Privacy Act.
More than 1,000 demonstrators chanting anti-FBI slogans and carrying Puerto Rican flags marched through the capital of this U.S. island territory yesterday. Demonstrators chanted, "Respect Puerto Rico" and "FBI Get Out." Many of the marchers favored independence for the island and accused the FBI of persecuting the movement. They also accused the FBI of letting Filiberto Ojeda Rios, the fugitive leader of a pro-independence militant group, bleed to death during an FBI raid in September. Federal agents have said they shot Ojeda Rios after he fired on them, but his widow said the FBI fired first. Rios was wanted for the 1983 robbery of a Wells Fargo armored truck depot. Demonstrators also chanted against the FBI tactics. FBI agents on February 10th searched 5 homes and a business to thwart what the agency said was a domestic terrorist attack planned by independence militants. Luis Fraticelli, special agent in charge of the FBI on the island, has said the alleged attack would have involved explosives directed at privately owned interests and the public in Puerto Rico. As word spread it that the FBI operation, reporters gathered outside an apartment building in the San Juan area as agents searched. A television station broadcast image of federal agents using pepper spray on reporters and protesters, prompting complaints from journalists associated on the island. Fraticelli had said agents used non-lethal force when protesters and the media tried to cross a law enforcement perimeter. Hundreds of Afghan soldiers with tanks and grenade launchers surrounded Kabul's main prison Sunday after rioting inmates seized control of much of the facility in an uprising that officials blamed on Al-Qaeda and Taliban militants. Local media reported several people were killed and dozens injured, but appeared security forces had yet to gain access to parts of the jail under prisoners' control, so officials could not confirm reports of casualties. One official said at least 4 inmates were injured. Gunshots occasionally rang out. Troops tried to keep the prisoners bottled up. Officials said the rioters did not have any firearms, but had armed themselves with small knives and clubs fashioned from wreck furniture. Smoke could be seen curling out of some cell windows where inmates apparently set fire to bedding and furniture. Government negotiators late yesterday suspended talks to end the standoff at the notorious Pulcharki jail, which later this year is slated to receive dozens of Afghans currently in U.S. military's Guantanamo prison.
According to Reuters, 2 alleged Al-Qaeda bomb makers make their first appearances before a U.S. military tribunal at the Guantanamo Navy base this week. This as the U.S. Supreme Court prepares to decide whether the tribunals are legitimate. A Yemeni, said to have been a bodyguard for Osama bin Laden, is also scheduled to appear in hearings that begin on Wednesday at the remote and controversial U.S. base in southeast Cuba. The trio are among only 10 prisoners at the camp who have been charged with crimes. Guantanamo holds nearly 500 foreign captives, and UN human rights investigators have urged Washington to shut it. It's long been a focal point of criticism of the United States, with accusations that the mostly Muslim detainees have been tortured and humiliated. Charges like that are denied by U.S. Military officers at the base. U.S. federal judges halted 3 of the trials pending a U.S. Supreme Court ruling on whether President George W. Bush had authority to create the tribunals and try foreign terrorism suspects after the September 11th attacks. The Supreme Court is scheduled to hear arguments in the case on March 28th. And to rule in June or July. This has been the KABU Morning News for Monday, February 27th. Chris Andre edited the news, KABU volunteers edited the tape stories, and Jim Thompson is on the board right now. KABU AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Blaine Palmer.
And I'm Martha Odom. Portland area weather today, rain at times, decreasing north in the afternoon, highs in the 50s. Tonight, a chance of showers north in the evening, otherwise rain south down the Willamette Valley, lows from 35 to 40.
Thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us this evening at 5 p.m. for the KBOO Evening News.
Wondering what to do with all that news on your mind? Volunteer in the KBOO Morning Newsroom. Call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202, to find out how you can get involved. Visit our website at www.kboo.fm.
Stay tuned all morning for KBOO's fabulous programming, and thanks for listening.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.